Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
You're listening to New Books in Geography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host for today, Stentor Danielson, from the Department of Geography, Geology, and the Environment at Slippery Rock University. Today, I'll be talking to Kat Button, editor along with Gerald Taylor Aiken of Over-Researched Places, Towards a Critical and Reflexive Approach, published this year by Routledge. Dr. Button, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you.
To start off, why don't you tell our listeners a bit about your background and how you came to write this book?
Hi, so I can't even start the first question, sorry. So I'm the Director of Planning and Urban Design in the School of Architecture, Planning and Landscape at Newcastle University. But my PhD was in geography, and that's how myself and the other editor, Gerald Taylor Aiken, met. And we started to think through our own research about the different ways in which, well, I'm not sure if anywhere can be over-researched, but the way in which certain places and certain ideas become very saturated with people looking into them, people inquiring into them. And for me, it was whilst I was doing my PhD and I was doing research in Mumbai in India, and I would find I was even sharing the room with other people interviewing the same person, that researcher saturation had got to that point that people didn't have time to meet researchers individually and were meeting people together. And when you went to conferences, finding that a quote would be put up and I'd be thinking, oh yeah, I spoke to that person. So it became this kind of interest for me to think, well, what does that do to my data? You know, not that we can deny that these things are happening, but kind of to try and be present in that and understand how that might shape the ways in which we think. And so myself and Gerald put together a call for papers for the RGS IBG conference in 2018, which is the Royal Geographical Society with the Institute of British Geographers. It's an annual conference, usually held in London, but that year was in Cardiff in Wales. And we used that as a chance to get together some people who were also thinking about these issues in other contexts and how other places of inquiry might be, you know, these kind of honeypot sites where lots of people were going, and try and unpack why that was happening and what the consequences of that might be. And it seemed like that was something that excited quite a lot of people as a way of thinking about places. And so from that, we developed the idea of putting together this collection.
Okay. So when I first saw the title of the book, the thing that came to my mind was the idea of research fatigue, where people get tired of having researchers constantly wanting to interview them and survey them and stuff. So how is your concept of over-research different from just research fatigue?
Yeah, so research fatigue is a really related concept to thinking of over-research. And I think it's part of it, but doesn't go far enough. So yes, research fatigue, certainly, that if someone is getting constantly researched, then they're going to show signs of fatigue, going to rehearse answers. As I said, they might bring several researchers together, they'll just tell you to look at the website, you know, that people, or just say no, because people do get certainly extremely fatigued. But this is to go further than that, to say there's other things going on as well. And I think each chapter takes a slightly different angle and looks at a different case study, a different place, to unpack that, but also to go further and to think about the consequences of that. Because I think very often the research fatigue gets discussed in the methods, maybe, and then it gets left and just be like, oh yeah, research fatigue. But actually, like, but what does that seriously mean? You know, what can we go further? Can we look into that in more detail and think about, so what? What is the consequence of someone being fatigued because there's too many researchers? Or, you know, does this have an effect on the data more generally? Because it becomes easier to research a certain place because there's lots of researchers, and it becomes, you know, the place to go and do that research. So that it's not necessarily a person being over-researched, but lots of people being in one place. Can a place have research fatigue? I don't know. So yeah, it's trying to take that concept further and say that's a part of it. And that, I think, is sort of a useful starting point to think about research fatigue. But then it's really sort of thinking, well, so what? There's something more going on. We can go beyond the research fatigue and dig a bit deeper into the different consequences of having lots of people looking at the same place or the same thing or the same people.
Yeah. So could you talk a little bit more about some of those consequences, not just for the people being researched, but also for the research itself, the research that we're getting out of these, you know, I like that term honeypot for these sites that get researched so much that this has consequences for the research, not just for the people being researched.
Yeah, so you can end up being tied into certain fashions, can't you? That there's certain places that then become the places to research, either because they're exceptional or because, as I said, they become easy to research because other people have trodden that path. And then that could be quite limiting because you'll keep going their path of resistance, and then we might end up making theories and extrapolating from a few case studies that might be quite exceptional because those have been the places that were accessible, that were those honeypots that lots of us researcher bees have been visiting, and creating, you know, ideas based just on those.
Yeah. And then why do certain places become over-researched? Why is it that people would, you know, all be congregating to the same place to research it?
It's a good question. And, you know, I think one thing that we wanted to think about was, actually, can somewhere be over-researched? Maybe that, you know, that somewhere can't be. Maybe you can't really saturate a place, but people do tend to congregate. As I said, I think partly it's because those are often the interesting places. Something about them has captured you, like Mumbai being a very rapidly growing city, being, you know, an economic center for a country, being a mega city. And those kind of conditions mean that lots of people can go there because they can be supported by the infrastructure there, that there's something interesting and exceptional about that place. And then I think it becomes a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy because, well, I've read lots of things about that place. I can find out a lot about a certain place because there's already lots of research on it. So it means that, oh, well, that might be a good place to add to that data on that place and, you know, create your project that's building on previous researches, which is great, but it means that it can end up being the same places that are visited. And as I said, I think it then also becomes, in some ways, you know, an easier place to research because people understand what the research processes are, that they understand, you know, what it is to be interviewed, or a place will understand, you know, people in a place will understand what those processes are and might be more accepting of them rather than having to understand the premise of researchers. So I can see why certain places become these honeypots. We do have one chapter in the book that's actually about a place that is rarely researched, and Hannah's chapter sort of thinking about, you know, why is it that somewhere might be under-researched, to kind of give like a counterpoint. And there is another book that she edited on that as well. So that's Hannah Rizchik, who did one of our chapters. So I think, you know, also trying to think about that there is a counterpoint, that some places kind of don't get looked at, don't get seen, and try to understand, you know, why is that? And, you know, which do you want to be? Do you want to be in the place that where there's lots of people and lots of previous research, or do you want to be treading into the new territory and somewhere where lots of people haven't researched, and I'm not sure there's an answer to that. I guess it depends exactly what you're looking at and why you're doing that. But I think that's another interesting thing about the book, that it's looking at really different global case studies. So my entry point was a megacity and a really fast-moving, vibrant place with millions of people. But we also have authors talking about the Arctic, and the Arctic is an over-researched place. So I think there's a huge contrast in different ways that the different chapters in the book are presenting this concept of over-research and how that might feel to the researcher.
Yes, yeah, so that actually kind of leads into another question that I wanted to ask, which was about how you selected the chapters that went into this and the range of places that are covered. You've mentioned a few, you know, Mumbai and the Arctic, Palestine, Redfern in Sydney. So these are a global set of places, but how did you go about choosing what places represent the idea of places that get talked about too much, basically?
Yeah, well, when we started looking into this, it seemed like there were, you know, limitless possibilities of places and ideas that people had. I think people don't often talk about the difficulties they have in research, but if I would talk about my research processes in Mumbai and how often I was seeing other researchers, and, you know, once at one point I shared, I was doing an interview with someone and a whole class full of students were brought in to talk to her, and she was much more interested in talking to them. All these different anecdotes that, you know, you talk to colleagues about. And almost everyone I spoke to was like, oh yeah, I've had this issue of, and they would be finding examples of over-research from their own work. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. So actually there was a huge range of places where this could have been. But in some ways, this was quite self-selecting. So we put out the call for papers for the conference in 2018 and had a selection of papers that were delivered there and had some great conversations. And then from that, Twitter's not as popular now as it was in 2018, but we were tweeting about it during the session and we had a bit of interaction about it. And from that, we're able to invite a few other people. One of the authors, Chandni Singh, wrote a blog post about this concept of over-research. And so we invited her to submit a chapter and a few other people that had shown interest. So it was in some ways sort of self-selecting in who had come forward and shown an excitement about creating a chapter for this book. And then when we looked at it, we thought that's actually a really great spread of different places and different topics that people were looking into, because I think the geographical spread is important, but also the way in which people have approached it, because a lot of this is thinking about positionality, that we've got some people who are seeing themselves as somewhere between a tourist sometimes and a researcher, some people seeing themselves like going back to somewhere where they had previously spent a lot of time. So I think there's a range of things, and also thinking in different concepts and thinking about how places have changed over time, about how somewhere like Yugoslavia might be, it's not that the place is over researched, but the way that it is reproduced in that research, and that the same narrative might be told over and over again. So it's about a good spread of places in the world, but also of the different positionalities and the different approaches that people have taken to unpacking what over-research looks like in their research.
Yes, and then another theme that crops up a number of times is the way that kind of the structures of academia, right, like the expectations that we have and the limits that we have as, you know, a university researcher, which most of the people that are writing here, that's kind of the position they have to go do research. The way that the structure of that position affects the way that they can deal with the various issues that arise in trying to do research in an over-researched place, trying to, you know, be ethical and also be responsible in their research and the way they do it, that's constrained by the demands of academia. So Could you talk a little bit about that idea about the way that, you know, the way that the position of being a researcher is set up affects what we can do when we engage with an over-researched place?
Yeah, I think it's something that perhaps doesn't get reflected on very often, that how when we go and research somewhere, we might even in incremental ways be changing that place and changing what other people might think about that place as well. So it emerges, you're right, as a theme across quite a few chapters. I mean, sort of thinking about the chapter on Palestine and Israel and how the number of researchers there really changing that narrative and changing potentially the stories and support levels, and how do you navigate that field as a place of research. And in my own chapter, thinking about, I talked about it as ghosts of researchers, past, present, and future, just to thinking about those kind of echoes that we do leave. And I think the book sort of calls us to be mindful of that and to think about it, because, you know, in the ethics that we do, it's very often about our research and exactly what we will do in that space of time when we're physically doing the research, doing our interviews or our surveys or whatever methods we might use, but quite contained within that moment. And actually have a bit of a reflection, particularly about what we do might create for the future researcher, that, you know, that we might, you know, upset someone that we interview and they never want to be interviewed again, or how, you know, if we're making the path easier or harder, or just by the fact of doing that research, meaning that some place is becoming over-researched. And I don't know, it's a really complicated question and really ethical question that I think you're right, that a lot of the authors kind of struggled with this idea and the shifting of their positionalities as well, that you know, am I an activist in some moments and a researcher in other moments, and how do you ethically position yourself within that? But I think all of it comes from just being mindful of the process and of the other people involved in that moment, but also who's gone before you and who's coming after you within that potentially over-researched place.
Yeah. So I now want to circle back to something that you kind of touched on in an earlier answer, which is the idea that we're specifically talking about over-researched places. So this is about place, not just about, you know, people who happen to live in a certain place, or that you know, research by going to a place, but the place itself getting over-researched. And, you know, as a geographer, that especially, you know, is something that I was thinking about as I was reading the book. So in what sense is a place, not just a group of people, getting over-researched?
Good question. Yeah, because I guess, because I'm thinking of it from a social scientist approach, I'm always thinking about the people that I'm talking to. But you're right, this is about the places. That's kind of the framing that we put on this. And I think, oh, there's a lot of different ways in which you could come at that question. But I think, you know, it's about how much knowledge is produced about one place and how that can shape, as I said before, like how that focus on a few places could kind of shift and change and warp the theories that we make and the places that then other people go to visit. But also that from the number of researchers being in a place, that can change it, could change the makeup of it. If you end up with a serious number of researchers who are very often quite short-term visitors in a city, you know, that's a different set of needs that those people have over the residents that are there. That, you know, when you go somewhere, you're there for a month or so or 6 months or whatever, then you might have different requirements, you might have a different level of income. So again, it's that positionality. When you get to that point where the over research is very high, you could be changing what's provided there. You could be changing the environment if there's lots of researchers, you know, going into the Arctic. So I think, yeah, we're really thinking about that place and how it might physically change in those ways. But as I said, it's also about how we make theories and decisions about places and, you know, how policy is made about places often reflects the research that's been done. And if that research is just on a limited number of these honeypot sites that lots of research is attracted to, then does that limit the decisions and the types of policies that might be made? So I think it does go beyond just the people and thinking about place more generally.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Okay. And so then to drill down a little bit into some specifics, you had mentioned that your personal experience with an over-researched place was with Mumbai. And so I was hoping you could expand on that a little bit and talk about, you know, for your personal experience with that, how did you handle the issue of over research in your own work in that particular place?
Yeah, so Mumbai really does attract a lot of researchers, and it was quite a difficult thing to navigate. And I think I dealt with some of it after the fact by reflecting on it in my methods and more broadly, and, you know, explaining what's happened and being very clear about, you know, if a question in an interview was asked by someone else, then thinking, well, actually, do I make that clear or do I just not use the response to that question? So I'm thinking about time when I was talking to a representative from an NGO, and there was myself who was doing a PhD in human geography, and I was looking at rainwater harvesting systems that are being implemented in domestic homes to improve the security of the water supplies. And there was also someone talking to the same person, and she was doing some research into social work within the same area of Mumbai. And so he just invited us both along to do the same interview. So then you're sort of thinking, well, I haven't got, you know, I've got him to sign a consent form, but I didn't, you know, bring something for this person because I didn't know she'd be there. And then thinking about, well, you know, like, oh, well, do I, in the end, it ended up not being a problem, but I was sort of thinking, right, how, if he gives a really good answer to one of her questions, how do I deal with that when I come to write it up? But because her what she wanted to know was so different from mine, that kind of didn't come up. But it was sort of like, how do you steer it back and like be fair to both people? So there was, some of it was negotiating it in the room, and some of it was kind of after the fact when I'm writing it up, just being honest and really trying to take that kind of feminist stance of, you can't remove yourself or the context from your research. You do have to acknowledge what happened, who was there, and that you're a part of it, and that research is a messy process. It's not this linear thing that happens and you know, you plan it carefully and you start at A and you end at B. It tends to wind and change and evolve. And so I really tried to acknowledge that and how the number of people did affect it. And, you know, that there was a whole class of school children speaking Marathi, which unfortunately I don't. I got a little bit of Hindi, but I don't speak Marathi, which is the majority language in Mumbai. And of course they were more interesting than I was. And sometimes you just have to go, okay, fair enough. These primary school children are more interesting. And just sort of, yeah, I don't know. I did it made it difficult, but also super interesting. And I think maybe writing this book was a way of dealing with it as well. They get to find that, oh, it's not just me that's thinking about this, and get some kind of catharsis from writing it out and talking about it. Because I think it does, you know, it made some things easier because people did open their doors to me, understand what research was, but it made some things harder because a lot of the research that people have been exposed to was either hard science, or it was the kind of social science that is a clipboard and a questionnaire, which isn't what I wanted to do. I wanted to walk and talk and look at systems and have interviews, and, you know, that people had an idea of what research was, and it wasn't necessarily what I wanted to do. So yeah, in some ways it's easier because people understand research, but it can be difficult if that isn't exactly what you were thinking of doing.
It's a thing I appreciate about the book is that it shows some of this messiness of the research process, that we usually kind of iron that all out when you write up, you know, an article, and it makes it sound like you had this theory and you went to the place and you did the thing and got your answer, and it was all very, you know, linear and clean.
It becomes sanitized, doesn't it, when most people write up their research? It's this very sanitized version of what happened, because it shows what was achieved and doesn't show the problems that bumped up against in during the process.
So then I think the natural next place to go is to ask, so what do we do about this? Because you know, you argue that it's not enough to just say, well, some places are over-researched, so everybody should pick new sites to do their research in. So what should we be doing to address the issues that you're raising about over-research?
Wow, the million-dollar question. Yeah, we're not saying, oh, these places have too many people in them, don't go there. That's, you know, not what we're saying. And we actually wanted a question mark originally in the title, but publishers do not like having punctuation in their titles. We wanted it to be over-researched places. Like, can they be? Like, is this what's happening? Because it was sort of a questioning of whether somewhere can be over-researched. And I think that's kind of the key, that it is about a questioning. It's about a reflection and being, I guess, reflexive, rather than just, you know, going about and barging in and going places that everyone else does and just doing the research without reflecting on why have I chosen this place and what does it mean that there was lots of research already written about this place? What does it mean that I'm meeting other researchers while I'm here? And I think that for us was where we ended up, that we really think about it and be purposeful in our choices and understand what this means for the research that we do and the theories that we generate or the future research that we then go and do. I don't think we have a magic formula for dealing with or overcoming research, over-research. I think there's some suggestions in some of the chapters, people sharing what they did, how they dealt with it, either in the time or in their reflections of ways they might go forwards with it. So I think each chapter perhaps suggests a slightly different tack that you could take when you're thinking about how to deal with this over-researched issue, if we think of it as a problem. But it might be that you look at this and think, oh, actually, no, I really want to go to this place that lots of other people have been to, and that there's all this rich data already existing and all these things written on it. And I think that that's fine. It's just having that thought, thinking through that process and having that reflection. So it really is a big call to just look, this is an interesting thing. Let's think about this some more and purposefully approach it and reflect that in the theories that we then make about places.
All right. So then as we're moving towards the end of our time here, I wanted to give you an opportunity to give a shout out or a thank you to anyone whose help was important to you as you were putting this book together.
Oh, that wasn't a question I was expecting. I guess, a massive shout out to the other editor, Gerald Taylor Aitken. I think it was great to collaborate with him, and we worked really well together, and really nice to continue a relationship with someone who you met during your PhD and, you know, continue that contact and actually create something together. So massive shout out to Jerry. And to the editors at Routledge and Taylor Francis Group. It's always a very confusing, the relationship between those two things. It changed a few times, but they were all very helpful. And yeah, just thank you so much to all the authors for getting their things written and responding to our comments, even if we took ages to get those comments together. Just a massive thank you to all of the chapter authors, because I think this is a great collection of really different perspectives. So yeah, thanks to everyone, really.
All right. Yeah, and I'll mention for our listeners, we did try to get Gerald on, but it was just got too complicated with the time coordination because we're in three different countries. You know, Kat, you're in the UK, I'm in the United States, and Gerald's in Luxembourg, right?
That's correct. Yeah. So three different time zones, really difficult.
Okay, so then that brings us to our traditional final question, which is, what are you working on next?
Ooh. Well, at the moment, I'm involved in more research into water, which is my real focus. And I'm involved into UKRI GCRF hubs, one of which focuses on water security and sustainable development. And in that one, I'm looking at kind of how we value water beyond it being H2O and beyond monetary values, thinking about the cultural significances of water. And how it's really important to understand what water means to people if you're going to come up with solutions for it or any kind of policy about water. If you want that to be effective, you really need to understand how people feel about their water. And the other one is living deltas, which is thinking about livelihoods in deltas. And they're both quite worldwide projects and super interesting, thinking about our relationships with water fundamentally. Yeah, and some of those might be over research places, of course. Maybe I can reflect on that as well. But that's what I'm working on at the moment. And hopefully we'll write some things from that.
All right. Well, if any of that writing turns into a book, we'd love to have you back to talk about it.
Oh, I would love that. Great.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
You're very welcome. Thanks.
This has been a conversation with Kat Button, editor, along with Gerald Taylor Aiken of Over-Researched Places, Towards a Critical and Reflexive Approach, published this year by Routledge.